Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Charlie Hostler is one of the titans of weather forecasting. In the late 50s, his state-of-the-art forecasts were transmitted by microwave from Penn State campus to a local TV station, earning him rock star status with area farmers and impacting weather reporting nationwide. Hostler also left his mark on Penn State, having spent his entire professional career there. In April, he was guest of honor at the annual Wilson Banquet, a program he started as Dean of the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. I caught up with him there and asked him to reflect on his nearly 75 years at Penn State.
Well, talk about institutional memory. You arrived at Penn State in 1942, and you spent your entire professional career here, beginning as instructor, retiring at the end of 1991 as acting executive vice president and provost. So when you look in your rearview mirror, you have a view of Penn State that spans nearly 75 years. Describe the Penn State that you knew in its early days and some of the highlights that shaped and influenced its place in the world today.
Well, I arrived here in, I think it was in May 1942. I grew up, of course, during the Depression. We were very poor and had no money, lost the house, the usual things. And in my senior year in high school, one of the teachers spoke to my parents and said they thought I ought to go to college. But it didn't seem there was any kind of way I could do that. I took an examination in Chester County, Pennsylvania. I came in second, so I didn't get the top scholarship. But my father was able to borrow $200 from the local bank, and I came to Penn State with a check for $200.
Which you paid back.
Which I paid back 2 years later when I was in the Navy. So I was on my own from an early age. We came into State College. State College had no traffic lights. There were two policemen in State College. At night, you could taste the air. In the wintertime, everyone burned soft coal. That was one of the principal occupations of students to earn money, was tending the furnaces in the rooming houses and in the buildings downtown. There was no radio station here. There was a telegraph station, and when they played football, the telegraph station would paint the score as it came in on Graham's cigar store next door. So the students would stand around and watch for what the score would be when they were playing away from home. It was a small town. To give you an idea, those of you who know where Easterly Parkway is, that was a trout stream. In the spring, you could catch a nice batch of native trout there. I hunted for pheasants and rabbits there. A lot of students came with their shotguns. Imagine what would happen now.
And you lived in the attic of a house with 11 roommates and a family of four sharing one bathroom.
That's right. Where the Days Inn is down there at the 234 South Pew Street. That's where my father dumped me off with a trunk. The Frasers had this rooming house that were. There was one small bathroom on the second floor, and there were 11 students, the family, and the boxing coach, Leo Hout, who lived in that house. You can imagine on Saturday night what it was like in the bathroom. But I didn't feel badly about that because everybody was poor in those days. Most of the kids here were Depression kids and weren't used to having fancy things, but that bathroom was a little much.
You arrived from the little town of Honeybrook, population 600,
yeah.
And you joined the sons and daughters of farmers and iron workers and other students from modest backgrounds who couldn't afford a private college tuition, or perhaps you might have ended up at MIT and not getting your all three of your degrees from Penn State.
Right.
What did a Penn State education mean to you and the comparatively few young men and women in that time who were lucky enough to go off to college?
Well, it meant everything. I mean, I figured I'd wind, when I was in Honeybrook, I figured I'd wind up as a clerk in the store or something like that. That's what kids did.
And even bright kids, you said.
Even the smart kids. The smartest kid in my high school class actually worked in a parts place for tractors. He was much smarter than I was, lived next door to me. Yes, this was a tremendous opportunity. And a lot of people flunked out too. They just couldn't take it either financial, and they would leave for financial reasons. In my opinion, the greatest thing that ever happened in this country, and one of the greatest things in the world, was the Land Grant Act in 1855, I guess it was, the Morrill Act, which up until then, all over the world, only the elite went to college, usually to study for the ministry. But the Land Grant Act opened up college to everyone, literally. And I think the whole economy and technology and so forth of the world was influenced by that, because suddenly there was an explosion of people who had come from talented families who never did anything, but as my family did, my family is mostly Swiss or German, that came here in the 1730s, driven out by the religious wars in Europe. They were Anabaptists, many of them, that were either sold as galley slaves to the Italians or drowned in the lakes of Switzerland or burned at the stake because they wouldn't baptize their babies. So that was like the Jews who came here prior to World War II and during the war. They were driven out of Europe and didn't expect much, and they picked the stones and cut down the trees and pulled the stumps and didn't expect anything more of life. But the Land Grant Act opened up the possibility of going to college and advancing. And I must jump ahead and say that one of my greatest feelings of satisfaction at this page of approaching 92 is that I have seen the sons and daughters of hundreds of illiterate parents, migrant workers, children, get PhDs at Penn State, start businesses, become multimillionaires.
And make a real difference in the world.
It made a real difference for the whole world.
So people who talk about Charlie Hostler always say he's always teaching. And on the other hand, you are the very definition of a lifelong learner. You signed up for everything in the Navy, studied at MIT and Bucknell, took correspondence courses at night, gave speeches and sat in on other lectures when you were in all kinds of places around the world sharing your knowledge. I'm wondering what it was that motivated you in the first place to go to college. You've talked about this inertia, this cultural inertia, yes, that keeps really bright people from making that step.
Yes, and it still happens. I attended a meeting yesterday where they talked about a young lady who turns out one of the brightest graduate students in the country in astrophysics, comes from Falls, Pennsylvania. Now, I don't know what the population of Falls is, maybe 47, if that. Just that type of thing, it's so satisfying to me and so valuable to the country that these people from nondescript families who never achieved anything in a material sense except to work their farms and so forth did so well. Actually, I was in chemical engineering at Bucknell, and it's called a V-12 unit. There were universities all over the country. That one happened to be run by the Marine Corps, and we had Marine drill instructors running it. So you had classes 8 hours a day, and then the 2 hours before the classes and in the evening, you ran the obstacle course and you played King of the Hill. You can imagine I weighed 124 pounds, how often I went up on the top of a hill. I got a lot of bloody noses. And it was pretty tough. And I duck waddled a lot. And one night I was walking across the quadrangle and somebody whistled. I can't whistle. And the sergeant thought I did it, and I had to hug a tree all night in the middle of winter. And so I volunteered for everything that came along, and underwater demolition or whatever. Finally, they said aerology, and I signed up for aerology, and the commanding officer called me in and said, Mr. Hostler, he said, you have the best grades or the second best grades in physics and math here at Bucknell. We're going to put you in this aerology program. He said, why did you want to be in aerology? I said, oh, all my life I wanted to be in aerology. So after I left these office, I ran over to the library and got the unabridged dictionary and found out what the hell I'd signed up for. And it turned out they sent me up to MIT, and they called it aerological engineering up there, which was a mixture of fluid mechanics and aerospace engineering.
And that's really what sparked your interest then in meteorology.
That's
this,
right. Well,
this then aerology program.
Then I got my commission, and then I went to the personnel office, and I said, I'm an aerologist. They said, we don't need none of them no more. They didn't know what that was either. So So the 21 of us who were in that program at MIT, the smartest people I ever met in my life, were sent to Miami to small craft school to learn how to sink submarines. And every day we ran out on the pier and jumped 30 feet into the water and swam back in the ocean. They said, "You're going to make us jump off the top of that theater." And heck, they would. And so then they explained to us that people were burning to death on the decks of aircraft carriers rather than jumping. And so they, one day they took us in the theater and explained this, and they took us up to the third balcony, and there was a little window. And we had to step out on the windowsill. It was 100 feet to the water, and you could see the bottom because the water was so clear. Next to fighting Joey Archibald, the world featherweight champion, that's the worst thing I ever did, jump 100 feet into the water.
Your first forecasting job was in Pearl Harbor. And yep. Here you were putting to work your newly acquired meteorology skills. And you were put to the test. The stakes were very high. Tell us a little bit about what that entailed.
Before I was a forecaster, I was staging for the invasion of Japan. I had a beach assigned on Kyushu, and I was to run this PC-1258, a little patrol boat, up on the beach and direct the Marines as they came in. So I knew where I was going to end up, period. But once the war ended and Harry Truman dropped the bomb, I was assigned finally to forecaster in the Fleet Weather Central on Pearl Harbor. And there we forecast for the whole North Pacific, sometimes with three pieces of data.
From a windowless bunker.
In a bunker under the ground. You know, every day we'd put out the forecast for Pearl Harbor, and it'd be northeast wind 14 to 15 miles an hour with gusts of 20 and temperature 72 and so forth. And we had no window to look out. And one day, suddenly all the telephones began to ring, and the admirals and the generals were on there. What the hell's going on? And the ships were banging into each other in the harbor because they were swinging around on their moorings. Two submarines nearly were sunk. And we didn't even know what was going on. It turned out a cold front had come through that wasn't on our map. So I learned, and I taught all my students, and some of them remember it to this day, before you ever issue a forecast, look out the window. When the front went through the ship, the wind there was always from the northeast, but suddenly it became northwest, and that's why all these ships swung around in the way. Well, then I went to Guam and was a forecaster on Guam, and on Guam, we still had 3,000 Japanese in the jungle or occasionally shooting a Marine guard or something, and I was sitting there on a weather map complaining about the security. We had to generate our own electricity. And every now and then they would sabotage the generators, and you'd have to go out and fix it. And you had to get the key to the commanding officer's office. And then you had the key to his desk. And then a key to a cabinet. And there was a key in the cabinet to open the locks to the generators. And you had to do all this in the dark. And I was complaining about that, and I didn't know the commanding officer was standing behind me. And the next morning he called me in and said, "Hostler, how would you like to fly Typhoon reconnaissance?" I said, "I would nothing like that in my mind." He said, "Well, you just volunteered." But I got flight pay and hazardous duty pay to fly at 200 feet for 12 to 14 hours a day.
Sometimes in the eye of the storm.
Yeah, and we had no radar, and half the time didn't know where we were. And fly into these typhoons. And we never got back with all four engines. Fortunately, we never lost more than two. We had pieces of the superstructure come loose. It was really pretty horrific stuff. We lost a third of our planes doing this.
You said leaking gas that was...
Instead of bombs, we had... There was a four-engine PB-4Y2, which was the Navy's version of the B-24. And we had auxiliary tanks in the bomb bay so that we could stay up for 14 hours. And the fumes were such that if somebody flipped a switch, you could blow up the whole airplane. We figured that's what mostly happened to the planes we lost.
If you're just joining us, I'm Patty Satalia, and this is Take Note, recorded live at the Nittany Lion Inn at the annual Wilson Banquet, hosted by Penn State's College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. Charlie Hostler, an emeritus Penn State administrator and a pioneer in weather forecasting, is the guest of honor. Hostler provided personal weather forecasts for President Dwight Eisenhower when his brother Milton Eisenhower served as president of Penn State.
You know, when you started as a meteorology instructor at Penn State, there wasn't much respect for this burgeoning science, and it wasn't until 1954 that meteorology became a full-fledged department at Penn State. You recount often an occasion when President Ralph Hetzel, who was president of Penn State at the time, he needed a forecast for an upcoming commencement ceremony that he wanted to hold outside. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, he wanted to have an outside commencement in Beaver Stadium, which at that time held 40,000 people. And I did the analysis, and it was a high pressure over the area. No possibility of any rain within 1,000 miles of here. And I told him not to worry about it, it'd be good weather, but there might be a little radiation fog in the morning. And the son of a gun, he went to the commencement, and there was fog in the morning. So he made his own forecast. So he moved the commencement indoors. There was no air conditioning. The people were passing out. It was a terrible situation. They couldn't all get in. And he got up on the podium, and the first thing he said was, well, we were going to have this outdoors, but the weatherman said it was going to rain. So I, having dealt with people like that, the generals and the admirals were terrible. They never paid any attention. But at any rate, I wrote him a note and said I thought this was pretty disgusting if the president of the university would get up there and lie like that. Well, my department head, who was a refugee from Germany, a Jewish refugee, and was very attentive to authority, was horrified that I had
Hans
written this
Harvard
letter to the president of the university telling him he was a liar, you know. The other thing happened, the dean of women pulled the same thing. They used to have a maypole dance, so the girls would dance around the maypole and with the ribbons attached to the pole and so forth. And she called up and wanted to know what the weather was going to be. And I told her it was going to rain like the devil. They couldn't possibly do it. So she made her own forecast, and they went ahead. And the girls had mud up to their knees, and the crepe paper all went away. It was a real disaster. But then she found out what the symbolism of the maypole was. And that was the end of the maypole dance.
Well, President Hetzel,
you may not know anything about the Druids and the maypole. It was a fertility rite.
President Hetzel and the person in charge of this dance may have had doubts about forecasts back in the early 50s, but Air Force One had complete faith in a Penn State forecast. So tell us about the 1950s during Milton Eisenhower's Penn State presidency. And I think many will remember that at the very same time, his brother, Ike Eisenhower, was president of the United States.
Well, Milton Eisenhower was really co-president of the United States. If you want to go to the library and pick up his book, The President Is Calling, you'll find out about it. Because he spent every weekend of his presidency at Penn State in the Lincoln bedroom in the White House. He was co-president. He wrote speeches. He advised him on many things. He was ambassador at large to South America that nobody here ever knew about. His chauffeur, his secretary, and I were probably the only ones that knew, because he had to get back and forth to Washington all the time. They flew an Aero Commander into the local State College Air Depot, which was a grass field out toward Pine Grove Mill. And so I spent a lot of time talking to Milton Eisenhower, and so I got to know him very well. And he appreciated my forecast. And then in 1955, the 100th anniversary of Penn State, they had a big special thing where I came up here to make a speech at commencement. And again, they were going to have it in Beaver Stadium, which held 40,000 people. And it had about 2 inches of rain during the night. It was pouring rain in the morning. And they were worried that they had made no provision to go indoors. And they could go into Rec Hall, but they had 40,000 people wanting to get in where they could seat 4,000 or 5,000 at most. And so the secretary to the president came over to my office, actually cried like a baby. He didn't know what to do. The Secret Service was all worried. So I got a call from the White House switchboard, and would I come down to the president's house, which was then on the campus. And so I wrapped up my weather maps and went down, and I actually split a grapefruit with Dwight Eisenhower and sat down and talked about the D-Day forecast a little bit. And in typical Eisenhower fashion, he said, well, I said, you're the expert. That was one of the Eisenhower characteristics. They weren't Trumps, you know, they didn't know everything. So He said, I haven't worried about the weather since D-Day. He says, you're the expert, you make the decision. I said, we're going to go outdoors. This was a long reach for me, you know, and no radars or anything. All night I sat up and plotted the hourly weather data from all the airports. Anyhow, I figured there'd be a little window in there, and I told him it'd be 2 hours, it could have commencement, it was going to rain like the devil afterwards. Well, it stopped at the right time, it started at the right time. Well, he thought I was a genius. You know? But it was just sheer luck. After that, Dwight Eisenhower never went anywhere in Air Force One without either personally or having Colonel Draper, who was the pilot of Air Force One, check with me. He had the whole weather service and the air weather service and all at his disposal. But to be quite frank, and this is a little lesson, there are a lot of people in the world who know a lot of things but are afraid to make decisions and afraid to take the risk. And if I had any characteristic, it was that I was willing to make a decision. I knew a decision had to be made, and rather I make it than the dean of women or the President Hetzel.
You know, we might add that President Eisenhower actually intervened on your behalf. You were in the Naval Reserves, and you were called up, and he said, no, you're needed at Penn State, where you had 32 Air Force officers being trained by you.
Yes, I was solely responsible for their forecasting training. And because Milton knew me, Milton intervened with his brother, I was at a dinner in Italy, sitting there eating spaghetti, and there was a Navy Rear Admiral sitting there, and I was introduced, and he said, you're that SOB that the President of the United States, for the first time in history, intervened and kept out of the service. But I was assigned to go to Rota, Spain. It wasn't going to help the war effort very much. It was better that I stay here and do the teaching.
You took over as Dean of the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences in 1965, and you served in that position for 20 years. The first day on the job, you say that you discovered that the former dean had taken the entire staff. The only person left was one secretary, and you said, so basically you were starting this department from scratch. And in retrospect, you say it really wasn't such a bad way to start. You remember thinking, it's a pretty good college with potential to become a lot better. So I'm curious to know, what was your vision when you stepped into that leadership role in 1965?
Well, one thing I had in common with Joe Paterno, he and I had a discussion about this once in some correspondence, is that you know that everybody in the university can't be the best in the world, but you better all be darn well trying. And that's sort of been my philosophy, that you know you can't run faster than anybody in the world. I ran on the track team, I never came in better than third, but I figured I made some other people run faster. I did have that kind of philosophy, and fortunately, Eric Walker, who was the president at that time, and then Bryce Jordan, were the kind of people that felt the same way and wanted to really move ahead wherever we could. Now, I've seen departments at Penn State who've been lousy for the whole time I've been here. There are other departments who've ebbed and flowed. Others have been consistently good. But it is a matter of leadership, and the role of a leader in any respect, whether it's in the military or in a university, is to try to create the conditions under which people will aspire to do well.
And part of that for you was something you say you learned from your advisor, and that was sort of a hands-off. You want people to be self-motivated, sink or swim kind of an attitude.
Yes. I don't know how many people have flunked PhD students, but I flunked as many as I gave. And the reason was that I had a German advisor and an almost entirely German-Jewish committee for my PhD. And the German idea is that you don't take a whole lot of courses to get a doctorate. You select a problem and you try to solve it, and you do your research on your own. And if you produce a product that's acceptable, you get your degree. And I pretty much did that with my graduate students. And I must say that my graduate students were all very creative people who did very well, who started things like AccuWeather or AeroVironment or other companies.
Became the head of the National Weather Service.
Dick Colgren from Kersey, Pennsylvania up here became head of the National Weather Service. Penn State produced three heads of the National Weather Services. So this college has produced so many leaders of so many places. I could reel off Procter & Gamble, Core Labs is on the New York Stock Exchange. At one time, six heads of steel company. Copper's company in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh Plate Glass, all graduates of this college that did very well. I added up, I think, something like 16 graduates of the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences became heads of major corporations listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Two heads of the Bureau of Mines in Washington came from this college. Man for man, dollar for dollar, this has been one of the most productive college at Penn State, there's no doubt about it.
This may strike some as politically incorrect, but you say the importance of Penn State's unbeaten 1969-1970 football season can't be overestimated. In fact, you say that the national recognition of this young coach and a winning team was parlayed into, or how exactly was it parlayed into academic strength for Penn State?
Fortunately or unfortunately, sports is an important thing as far as the visibility of any college or university in this country is concerned. I was discussing with my son the other day that really sports is a substitute for warfare. I think people are born pretty competitive animals. And I think the more a nation has sports as part of its menu and the more people participate and are enthusiastic about it, less you're liable to get into other kinds of political, other disputes. And as I mentioned, Joe and I discussed this business of being excellent. And I think that somehow in the minds of people out there, excellence in sports translates into the general excellence of a university. It probably shouldn't be so, but is so. But it made it easier to recruit faculty and to recruit excellent students.
You played a profound role in the success and prestige of Penn State's College of Earth and Mineral Sciences, whether it was helping to create the college's close-knit and open-door environment through the Student Tuesday Tees, which continues in some variation today, to your responsibility in getting Walker Building built, something that took over 14 years to do. But I'm wondering, as you look over your career, what are you most proud of accomplishing?
I'm most proud of the students, not only my students, but the students at the whole university. University produced. When you stop and think of we've had politicians, we've had heads of corporations and banks and insurance companies, and the fact that we took the sons and daughters of the working classes and turned them into highly productive, creative people, whether they're artists or business people or teachers, thousands of teachers, thousands of engineers, having been a part of that, is my pride, and to have, in my case of my own students, see these poor students from illiterate families become go to the top of their professions all over the world. We produced the heads of the meteorology departments, and not only here in the United States, but the head of the weather service in Ethiopia, in Liberia, in Turkey, in Indonesia, in Thailand. All got their training here at Penn State. And to have that much impact on the world is a very satisfying feeling.
And on that note, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
That was Charlie Hosler reflecting on his nearly 75 years at Penn State. Hosler was the guest of honor at the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences annual Wilson Banquet. Now a professor emeritus of meteorology and senior vice president for research and dean of the Graduate School Emeritus, Hosler continues to support Penn State through the Charles and Anna Hosler Scholarship for Meteorology. To hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.